And this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the Iraqi military launches an operation to retake Tikrit, an attempt to aid those fleeing the fighting in Iraq.
They don't have food, water, non-food items like blankets, anything to sit on the floor, clothes. These are the immediate needs.
The FAA issues a notice restricting U.S. carriers from flying over Syria. Israel and Hamas continue talks after a ceasefire is extended and taking aim at poverty in Asia and Africa. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. The Iraqi military says it has begun an operation to force fighters from the Islamic State militant group from the northern city of Tikrit. Officials said the offensive began early today to retake the city, which is the hometown of the late Iraqi President Saddam Hussein. Monday, the U.S. military helped Iraqi and Kurd forces recapture a strategic dam in the north from the Sunni extremists. At the White House late Monday afternoon, President Obama held a news conference to talk about the U.S. assistance to Iraqi forces and Kurds fighting the Islamic State group, sometimes referred to as ISIL. Mr. Obama said he sees important progress across the spectrum of U.S. efforts in Iraq.
Over the last 11 days, American airstrikes have stopped the ISIL advance around the city of Erbil and pushed back the terrorists. Meanwhile, we have urgently provided additional arms and assistance to Iraqi forces, including Kurdish and Iraqi security forces who are fighting on the front lines. Today, with our support, Iraqi and Kurdish forces took a major step forward by recapturing the largest dam in Iraq near the city of Mosul. The Mosul dam fell under terrorist control earlier this month and is directly tied to our objective of protecting Americans in Iraq. If that dam was breached, it could have proven catastrophic, with floods that would have threatened the lives of thousands of civilians and endanger our embassy compound in Baghdad. Iraqi and Kurdish forces took the lead on the ground and performed with courage and determination. So this operation demonstrates that Iraqi and Kurdish forces are capable of working together and taking the fight to ISIL. If they continue to do so, they will have the strong support of the United States of America.
President Obama also said the U.S. will continue working to build an international coalition to address the humanitarian needs of the Iraqis. And he said the U.S. will continue to pursue a long-term strategy to turn the tide against the Islamic State militants by supporting Iraq's new government and working with key partners in the region and beyond.
Over the last week, we saw historic progress as Iraqis named a new prime minister designate, Haider al-Abadi, and Iraq's outgoing Prime Minister Maliki agreed to step down. This peaceful transition of power will mark a major milestone in Iraq's political development, but as I think we're all aware, the work is not yet done. Over the next few weeks, Dr. Abadi needs to complete the work of forming a new, broad-based, inclusive Iraqi government, one that develops a national program to address the interests of all Iraqis. Without that progress, extremists like ISIL can continue to prey upon Iraq's divisions. With that new government in place, Iraqis will be able to unite the country against the threat from ISIL, and they will be able to look forward to increased support, not just from the United States, but from other countries in the region and around the world. Let's remember, ISIL poses a threat to all Iraqis and to the entire region. They claim to represent Sunni grievances, but they slaughter Sunni men, women, and children. They claim to oppose foreign forces, but they actively recruit foreign fighters to advance their hateful ideology. So the Iraqi people need to reject them and unite to begin to push them out of the lands that they've occupied, as we're seeing at Mosul Dam. And this is going to take time. There are going to be many challenges ahead. But meanwhile, there should be no doubt that the United States military will continue to carry out the limited missions that I've authorized, protecting our personnel and facilities in Iraq, in both Erbil and Baghdad, and providing humanitarian support as we did on Mount Sinjar.
The United States first launched airstrikes in northern Iraq earlier this month against the insurgents, in part to prevent the killing of thousands of stranded Yazidis who had sought refuge in the Sinjar Mountains. In Geneva, the United Nations Refugee Agency said it is preparing a massive operation to provide aid to 500,000 people displaced in northern Iraq. The agency said tents and other supplies will be airlifted to Erbil, the capital of the Kurdish Autonomous Region, starting Wednesday. The UN estimates that 1.2 million Iraqis have been displaced by fighting this year since the Islamic State group took over large parts of northwestern Iraq. International Relief and Development is among the organizations trying to help in Iraq. Iqbal Al-Jabouri works with IRD's Iraq program.
We work with host communities, the grassroots communities, to do a bit of conflict mitigation, capacity building training, and we have some works with the internally displaced people that are right now are in thousands in the three areas in the northern parts of Iraq.
What are you trying to accomplish there?
We have worked in Iraq for a long time, since 2003, and our main objective is, of course, to assist the people in need, but as well as to improve the capacity, whether it's with the local councils, to deal with the crisis that is happening right now. And this is like a good example. A lot of people fled from ISIS attacks from their cities, and they went to a safer place, and the local councils, the local authorities had no clue what to do in such a crisis. Therefore, they need a lot of assistance. We have been there trying to assist them to improve that capacity.
What is the greatest need for these people?
Well, I would say the most important needs or the dire needs are food and water. Those people left their homes, their clothes, everything, and they just fled. And they don't have anything. Some of them were stuck in Sinjar Mountain. Some of them were stuck between the fights. And some of them are occupying public buildings, schools, mosques, or even in the streets. So they don't have food, water, non-food items like blankets, anything to sit on the floor, clothes. These are the immediate needs. And, of course, once this is provided, and it is a huge need, because they have it is there like a large number of IDPs, then we can talk about the other needs.
Do you see your work making a difference?
Yes, I do. We have, through the years, I've seen a lot of people who are really in need of assistance. We've managed to reach those people. Of course, as an organization, we can do so much, but it is so thrilling for me to see that we made a difference to a person's life, especially now. We have distributed water, food to a lot of people who couldn't find food to eat. I mean, in this day and age, how could you imagine finding a person not, hungry? To me, it is impossible to even conceive. So yes, we made a difference to a lot of people's lives, and I hope we continue to do so. It's not only, As an international organization, IRD has always tried to assist the people in need. And in Iraq, we've done that.
And it's bad enough for the adults, but the children, it must be impossible for them.
That's the hardest story. I mean, to see really the children, there is a large number of the population who fled the fights consists of children. And, in a conflict, it is always the weak, let's say, or the helpless or the vulnerable, as we call them, are the people who are hit the most, and children and women are of those. So we are trying to assist, but again, it has to be like an international community movement towards assisting those people. We are trying to assist the children as well, and the women.
What else would you need? Is there anything that people can do to help?
Well, definitely funding is the most important thing right now. I would call definitely for anyone's assistance to give any funding. That will help save people's lives. We are at this stage where there are not a lot of funds available for the organizations to work, and this impacts our work in saving people's lives. Therefore, if anyone has the capacity, to donate anything, that will be something great, because that will eliminate some of the needs out there to buy food and water and assist those people to, survive this. This will be awesome.
Iqbal Al-Jabouri, Senior Program Officer with International Relief and Development.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com. VOAnews.com. Online news for a changing world.
Palestinians are warning of renewed violence if Hamas and Israeli officials cannot agree to a deal before tonight's midnight truce deadline. The two sides are holding intense, indirect talks in Cairo after agreeing Monday to a 24-hour ceasefire extension, the third such truce in 10 days. The chief Palestinian negotiator, Azam al-Ahmed, said today the cycle of violence will continue in the Gaza Strip if the talks do not succeed. The announcement of the extension Monday came just minutes before the ceasefire was set to expire at midnight local time. There was no indication that negotiators are close to reaching a deal to stop more than a month of fighting between Israel and Hamas, which runs the coastal enclave along the Mediterranean. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on Monday warned the Israeli army is ready to respond with force if Hamas resumes firing rockets at Israel, as it did when the first ceasefire was about to expire more than a week ago. Israel's UN ambassador, Ron Prosser, Monday took issue with the way the United Nations has gathered casualty figures from the Gaza conflict.
Have you wondered where the UN gets its casualty figures from? I'll tell you where. From Hamas. Let me be perfectly clear. Israel regards every civilian casualty as a tragedy. But let's be honest about what is going on. Hamas purposely put its people in harm's way as part of a propaganda war.
Stephanie Dujarric, the spokesperson for Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, disputed Prosser's allegation.
So UN does not just take, does not get its casualty figures from Hamas. The Office for the High Commissioner of Human Rights, its protection cluster is tasked with trying to put together preliminary figures, which it does from various sources, including NGOs on the ground, health ministries, and puts together what it feels comfortable putting out.
Gaza Health Ministry official Ashraf Al-Khidra said Monday the death toll from the fighting had jumped to more than 2,000 Palestinians, the majority of them civilians, while UN officials, who often take more time to verify figures, put the number at 1,976. Secretary General Ban has taken a tough stance on Israel, especially on the deadly attacks on UN schools that have been sheltering civilians. But he has also repeatedly demanded that Gaza stop firing rockets at Israel and blamed Hamas for violating an earlier ceasefire. The U.S. Federal Aviation Administration Monday issued a notice to airmen restricting U.S. carriers from flying over Syria, citing what the agency calls the ongoing armed conflict and volatile security environment that poses a serious potential threat to civil aviation. It notes that armed extremist groups in Syria are known to be equipped with a variety of anti-aircraft weapons, which have the capability to threaten civilian aircraft. Earlier this month, the FAA restricted U.S. carriers from flying over Iraq. Scott Hamilton of the Washington state-based aviation consultancy, Liam Group, told VOA's Victor Beatty he is surprised the FAA did not act sooner, given the downing of Malaysian Airlines flight MH17, July 17th, over eastern Ukraine by a surface-to-air missile.
The fact that you had an airplane that was flying at 33,000 feet and it got shot down, suddenly they wake up and say there's a problem when you fly over a war zone, it's just mind-boggling.
I guess what's happening on the ground has forced the FAA to become, what would you say, more sensitive to what's going on the ground around the world?
I think that's a fair conclusion, and the FAA, unfortunately, has been known for decades as a tombstone agency. They don't take action until somebody dies, and as tragic as MH17 was concerned, that's the Malaysian flight that went down over the Ukraine after being shot down. But where in the world has the FAA been? This is just another example of tombstone mentality, and I think, as much as I hate to say it, because Congress always overreacts to stuff anyway, that somebody ought to be asking some tough questions of the FAA.
What impact will this have on transcontinental flights?
What the effect is it will mean longer routings, more cost in terms of fuel, wear and tear on the airplanes. But flying around hostile areas is not at all uncommon. You know, U.S. Airlines have been flying around the Korean Peninsula since the Korean War. To this day, you can't overfly North Korea. So anything going from Tokyo to China, for example, asked to fly around the Korean Peninsula or certainly around the North Korean airspace. So this is not new.
Todd Gerdes, founder of the Seattle-based website airsafe.com, says many carriers long ago came to the conclusion Syrian airspace was too dangerous.
Recently, I looked at one of the many commercial applications that are out there, a website that tracks commercial activity all over the world. And it's interesting that on this morning, August 19th, there was actually no commercial airliners of any kind flying over Syria in airspace. And surprisingly, there were quite a few over northern Iraq, but none over Syria. So this has been something that the FAA didn't have to come out with a change of ruling. I believe other countries, and more specifically other airlines, have seen fit to avoid that area while that situation sorts itself out.
There's an organization in Switzerland called the Small Arms Survey. They came out with a report recently indicating armed groups in Syria have an estimated several hundred portable anti-aircraft missiles that can easily be diverted to extremists and used to destroy low-flying commercial planes. Is it becoming increasingly dangerous to fly the world's skies today?
Well, it's increasingly dangerous for that reason that was mentioned, not just in Syria or in that region, but small shoulder-fired missiles are common throughout the world in conflict zones. Now, the bad thing about those missiles is that they can cause serious damage to large commercial airliners and may even shoot them down. One limitation that these systems have is that they typically can only be effective up to about 10 to 15,000 feet. When aircraft are flying at cruising altitudes, typically in the 30,000 to 40,000 foot range, those kinds of missiles won't be a hazard. But as MH17 has showed, if you have a new system introduced into an area, a system that has the capability to reach into the stratosphere, and if airlines are not aware of it, they could unwittingly fly into areas where they could be reached by these missiles. And it's unclear whether that sort of situation is happening right now in Syria.
Curtis says today's environment is making it more challenging for governments and carriers to determine which airspace needs to be avoided. He says there are only a handful of countries, especially the United States, with the capability of cataloging the threats that exist. He says the challenge is devising a way to quickly transfer that information to global civil aviation organizations without compromising the sources or methods that make civilian aviation safe.
China is a fascinating country
with interesting people doing amazing things.
Every Friday, we focus attention on some of our favorite things coming out of China during the previous week.
It may be political, it may be cultural.
It may simply be a curiosity that caught our attention.
But we'll find stories sure to be of interest.
And then, of course, we'll add our own American perspectives as well.
I'm Sarah Williams.
I'm Jim Stevenson.
Join us for China Focus every Friday at 12 hours Universal Time on VOA Radio.
And anytime on the web at voanews.com and on Facebook VOA Asia.
An American foundation and a U.S. government agency have announced a new partnership, which has initial funding of $100 million intended as a bold new vision for building resilience to disasters and other factors contributing to poverty across Asia and Africa. VOA correspondent Steve Herman in Bangkok has the story.
Data showing that one of every $3 spent on international aid during the past 30 years has been lost because of recurring crises is prompting a new initiative to break the costly cycles of suffering. The project is called the Global Resilience Partnership. Its co-founders hope that the initial financial commitment to it will soon double to $200 million, with help from governments, companies, and other stakeholders. The Regional Development Director in Asia for the U.S. Agency for International Development, Michael Yates, at a Bangkok news conference, explained that investments across sectors to make communities more resilient to disasters would help hundreds of millions of households.
We know that we can't stop typhoons and earthquakes, but we can certainly do a much better job preparing for them and helping people to bounce back far more quickly and far more robustly afterwards.
USAID is introducing the Global Resilience Partnership with the Rockefeller Foundation. The private organization's managing director in Asia, Ashvin Dayal, explains that the funders will seek ideas in a design challenge for solutions to build resilience that can be scaled for vulnerable communities.
What does a resilient person look like, or a resilient system, or a resilient community? And you start to understand it has some characteristics. For example, flexibility, the ability to adapt, some redundancy, in the system so that you have choices, excess capacity, things like that. These, again, sound conceptual, but they are very real things, and they are choices about how you then invest in a community.
Examples of resilience projects include stone-resistant housing, crop insurance, and better access to weather information. The approach is receiving an immediate endorsement from a key agency of the United Nations. Fenmin Khan is the Asia-Pacific head of the UN Office for Disaster Risk Reduction.
We believe that this initiative is important because it recognizes that working with the private sector is an essential part of building resilience. And without the private sector, we cannot prevent new risks from being created.
Because of poor infrastructure and lack of resources, low-income countries suffer about half of fatalities from disasters, although they are hit by only 9% of such calamities. The Rockefeller Foundation and USAID warn that food insecurity and the effects of climate change are among the other factors that demand a new approach for building resistance to disasters. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
New research identifies a chink in the polio vaccine's armor. A mutated polio virus that slipped through the vaccine's defenses was behind an unusual lethal recent outbreak, according to a new study. An intensive vaccination campaign was able to stop the 2010 outbreak in the Republic of Congo. But the authors say the research shows new and dangerous strains may emerge as polio eradication nears, and high rates of vaccination are the best available protection. VOA's Steve Barragona reports.
Polio usually paralyzes its victims. It's not typically fatal. But in the Republic of Congo outbreak, nearly half of the 445 people who got sick with the virus died. And virologist Felix Drexler at the University of Bonn says the patients were unusual in another way.
About half of them remember taking 3 doses of live vaccine. And that made it even more bizarre because if they had been vaccinated, they shouldn't be sick.
When Drexler and colleagues in Europe and Africa studied the virus, they found it had some never-before-seen mutations in a critical part of its outer coat. Those mutations were in the place where antibodies that fight the virus would normally attach.
And so we thought, wow, maybe that could affect the ability of the antibodies in human blood to neutralize that virus. And yes, it did.
As they report in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, the researchers tested the virus in Germany against blood samples from people with better-than-average vaccination coverage.
Up to 30% had to be considered completely unprotected.
The Republic of Congo had been polio-free before the 2010 outbreak. It took 4 subsequent nationwide immunization drives targeting every man, woman, and child to stop the mutated virus. Drexler says the effort worked because just about everyone got vaccinated, and with the most potent form of the vaccine. The virus has not been seen since, though Drexler says it may still be lurking out there somewhere. And he added there may be others that also can evade the vaccine's protection. Although the vaccine works, Drexler says,
the question that the experts are asking, so is the vaccine good enough to enable us to eradicate poliovirus?
Experts say polio eradication is in its final stages. There have been fewer than 150 cases anywhere in the world this year, and the virus is found regularly in just 3 countries. Virologist Olin Q with the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says the problem in Congo was not the vaccine. It was civil unrest in the 1990s and early 2000s that had disrupted vaccination campaigns. He notes that the vaccine has eliminated the poliovirus everywhere it has been used.
What happened in Congo was it hadn't been used for quite a long period of time, and a susceptible group opened up. And then when the virus introduced, it had devastating effects.
More potent vaccines might be helpful, says Associate Director Walter Orenstein of the Emory Vaccine Center. But, he added, eradication is very close, and the tools at hand could do the job.
I think the most important message to me is we need to push hard and push fast and terminate transmission as quickly as possible.
Orenstein adds that if health workers can clear the last few pockets of virus, the discussion about mutant strains and stronger vaccines would be irrelevant. Steve Barragona, VOA News, Washington.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.
This is Today in History. On August 19th, 43 BC, the first Roman Emperor Augustus, born Gaius Octavius, forced the Roman Senate to elect him as consul after leading his army in a march on Rome. In 1839, French artist and inventor Louis Daguerre's early photographic process, known commonly as the daguerreotype, was made public by the French Academy of Sciences as a free gift for the world. In 1871, American aviation pioneer Orville Wright was born. Wright, with his brother Wilbur, is credited with being the first to achieve controlled powered flight in a heavier-than-air machine. The Wright brothers' first flight occurred in 1903. In 1942, in an operation named Jubilee, Allied forces unsuccessfully attempted a raid on the German-occupied French port of Dieppe. Many of the 6,000 mostly Canadian assault troops were killed, wounded, or captured. In 1953, Iranian Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh was removed from power in a coup led by forces loyal to Mohammad Reza Shah Pahlavi. In 1980, Saudi Arabian Airlines Flight 163 on a journey from Karachi to Jeddah returned to Riyadh's airport after fire broke out. Although landing safely, a lack of coordination prevented the evacuation of the plane and all 301 people on board, mostly Pakistanis, died. On this day in 1991, government hardliners attempted a coup against reformist President Mikhail Gorbachev. The coup failed to garner support of the army, and Gorbachev remained in office, but his power and influence was greatly diminished, and the Soviet Union was dissolved by the end of the year. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Simply put, without the ocean, there is no life on Earth. At the most basic level, the ocean produces 50 to 70% of our oxygen. It regulates our climate, absorbs carbon dioxide, and supports the greatest abundance of life on our planet. Today, some 12% of the global population makes its livelihood from the sea. And therein lies the problem. We humans are killing the ocean. As fishermen endeavor to supply the demand for seafood, they take too many fish, particularly the more popular species. Today, an estimated 29% of the world's fish stocks are overexploited, while another 61% cannot support expanded harvest and require effective management to avoid decline. Some stocks of tuna, swordfish, halibut, cod, and flounder populations have been devastated by overfishing. "The ocean is threatened today as never before," said Secretary of State John Kerry. "It is threatened by overpollution. It is threatened by climate change, which is having a profound impact on acidity of the ocean, which has an impact on all of the ecosystem, and it is profoundly affected by overfishing. There is too much money chasing too few fish, and most of the major fisheries of the world are either in extremis or near extremis." The Obama administration is particularly committed to improving the health of our ocean and is considering ways to expand protections for vast expanses of the Pacific Ocean, where the United States has jurisdiction. At Secretary Kerry's Our Ocean Conference in Washington this past June, participants from around the globe announced new commitments on the protection of more than 3 million square kilometers of the ocean, and dedicated more than $800 million to conserve the ocean and its resources. "We are committed to addressing the threats to the health of the oceans posed by climate change, as we have reduced our greenhouse gas emissions through strong action in the U.S., putting us on the path to meeting the U.S. goal of reducing emissions in range of 17% below 2005 levels by 2020, said Secretary Kerry. "Our hope is that in the next few years, there will be a new consciousness created about the responsibility to the ocean and the extraordinary connection of the ocean to everything we do and need to do on Earth itself."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.